All right, tonight we discuss the history of Israel, part 9, the 1960s golden opportunity. I thank again Becky and Avi Katz for sponsoring the lectures. L'ilui Nishmas Yonah ben Rav Aryeh Leib. 1960s were a tumultuous decade everywhere, certainly in one of the defining decades of the century, because it affected, changed life throughout the world. Israel would not look the same at the end of the decade as it did at the than it did at the beginning. But first we have to look back and see some of the important developmental events that change not only events on the ground, but the hashkafa, the psychological dimension of Israeli existence. On April 21st, 1951, the Knesset passed a law designating the 27th of Nisan as Holocaust Day. The day was called Yom HaShoah, V'zichron Mered HaGetot. The Holocaust Day and remembrance of the ghetto resistance, ghetto rebellions. Early on, it was a day that was only observed by survivors. And it was centered, the observances were centered in Kibbutz Yad Mordechai in the south, just north of Gaza, and Kibbutz Lochamei Geta'ot, right north of Haifa. It was a very politicized day. It was almost a celebration of resistance and nothing else. And the Labor Party and the Mapam, in fact, infused that day with a political dimension. They used it for years to make general statements of policy or innovations, etc. The 27th of Nisan was chosen for a very interesting reason. The date itself has no significance at all. The Knesset had wanted to commemorate the Holocaust through the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, but that, as we know, took place on Erev Pesach, which is not the most suitable day for this type of observance, because, of course, people get ready for Pesach, and most Jews are in hotels by then. So you couldn't make that a day, and it's not appropriate. The 4th and 5th of Iyar were already designated as Yom HaZikaron, Yom HaShoah. So in fact, Tisha B'Av was considered in the late 1970s when Menachem Begin became Prime Minister. He even proposed that the date be shifted from Chaf Zayin Nisan to Tisha B'Av, but he was overruled for a number of reasons. He was too Jewish, and it was the summertime. The 27th of Nisan was chosen for a simple reason. It's exactly a week after Pesach ends, and exactly a week before Yom HaZikaron. It's right in the middle of that period. One member of the Mafdal, Mordechai Nurak, did not protest, said it was even an appropriate day because it's in the middle of the Omer, where we commemorate a number of tragic events. But he missed one point, and that is Nisan itself is a festive month. And there's an issur, it's in the Shulchan Aruch, to recite any memorial prayer, Kel Moly Rachamim, for example, during the month of Nisan. So in fact, the Haredim never accepted the day. Then again, they don't accept anything that a non-Haredi originates, but they never accepted. Many religious Jews didn't accept it. And because of that, it's one of these days that Ad Hayom really lacks definition and lacks a mode of observance. And people struggle to find some structure, give the day some structure. And now again this year we're in a situation whereby in Israel they don't want to celebrate, so they don't want to commemorate Yom HaShoah on a Sunday, because Chav Zayin Nisan, because that means the establishments have to be closed Motzai Shabbos, they lose too much money. They want to shift it to Monday. But once you start changing days around, you know, like it's a Memorial Day, a President's Day, it loses something in its observance. Now, in April 1959, a new bill was passed, and the name was changed from Yom HaShoah and commemorating the ghetto resistance to simply Yom HaShoah V'Hagevurah, the day of Holocaust and heroism, recognizing that there was more resistance than just inside the ghettos. Now, that day, and the name itself, Yom HaShoah V'Hagvurah, in our common parlance, we've almost dropped Hagvurah, but that was the name that was given. All the ambivalence, and all the schizophrenia, and all the trepidation that Israelis had in dealing with the Holocaust, really is summed up here. Why Hashoah v'Hagavurah? Because Israelis could not bring themselves to commemorate just the Holocaust, which to them is the epitome of Jewish powerlessness. So heroism was given equal billing, even though that is part of the story of the Holocaust, but we can't say it's a major part of the story of the Holocaust. But this Gvurah was in line with the sentiment of Israelis that they had to, in some way, commemorate it, but on the other hand, that the existence of the State of Israel proved that they had overcome the Holocaust and would never again face such a potential catastrophe. And so for political purposes, they always emphasize resistance rather than surrender, and that's why they look to the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising as the focal point of the commemorations. Now, even in 1951, when it was first observed, most of the country did not observe it. And in fact, a bill was proposed in the Knesset then to close down places of entertainment, and it was voted down. And on Yom HaShoah, in the early years, life was pretty much normal in Israel, with cafes and coffee houses and cinemas, etc., all open. Even after the day was changed and the observances changed, became more universal in Israel in 1959, still the day was basically passed unobserved. It wasn't until 2 years later, in 1961, that day took on the character that it has now, when another bill did pass, ordering by law places of entertainment closed, coffee houses closed, radio would devote its programming to the Holocaust. There was no television yet. And this was due to the Holocaust arousal in the wake of the upcoming trial of Adolf Eichmann. Now, the Eichmann trial was a galvanizing event in Israel. One of the most electrifying moments in the history of Israel, May 23, 1960, Prime Minister Ben-Gurion stood in the Knesset in the afternoon, early afternoon, and announced that Israeli security services had captured this monster, Adolf Eichmann, and he was already in custody, already brought before a court in Yafo. Amazing, there were no leaks. He had been seized a few weeks before, brought to Israel, and there were no leaks at all. It's almost unheard of such a thing could happen today. Newspapers issued special editions. All the political parties unanimously praised the government and the security services. Chief Rabbi, Sephardic Chief Rabbi Nissim, urged the death penalty on Eichmann, and he was charged with crimes against the Jewish people under the 1950 Nazis and Nazi collaborators law. Now, Eichmann himself was born in Linz, Austria, which has the very dubious distinction of being the birthplace of both Adolfs, Eichmann and Hitler, Yimach Shemam. Eichmann was an SS. Linz is not far from Mauthausen, by the way, if you've been in the area. Eichmann was an SS officer who was in charge of Jewish affairs. Now, he was, in Hannah Arendt's phrase, literally the banality of evil. He looked like a simple bureaucrat. And in fact, Arendt meant that in a pejorative sense. She covered the trial as a correspondent and was very disappointed in the trial. And she felt that they were almost picking on him, because who was he? He was like a faceless person, simple, short, balding, almost nondescript. But he was a bureaucrat whose task was to oversee the systematic execution of millions of people, of Jews, an entire race. In the late 1930s, Eichmann had been assigned to Vienna, where he was tasked with expelling Jews. And in fact, you know, in retrospect, it was a blessing for them. Because of him, 150,000 Jews who had been persecuted in the streets left amid the terror that Eichmann engendered, but they survived. During World War II, he was tasked with a different assignment. He coordinated and supervised and managed genocide. And he escaped after the war through an underground network in which the Vatican was somewhat involved. Now, at Nuremberg, eventually almost 1,100 people were convicted. The Nuremberg trials lasted probably 6 or 7 years, all told. But in the 50s, he was one of Israel's three prime targets, along with Martin Bormann, who was an aide to Hitler, and Joseph Mengele, the infamous doctor of Auschwitz. Of the 1,100 convicted, maybe a little more than 20 were executed. A few served, actually very few served life sentences. Most were sentenced to prison terms. Many were paroled after a certain time. And obviously tens and tens of thousands of Nazis escaped punishment. Mossad was able to track Eichmann to Argentina first in 1957. They got a tip from an Argentinian Jew, but he was only first pursued in 1959 seriously. He was living in Buenos Aires under the name Ricardo Clement, the famous house on Garibaldi Street. The government decided to capture him. The operation was directed on site by Isser Harel, who was the founder and longtime head of the Mossad. It was dangerous. It was illegal. It was an obvious violation of international law, tell the people outside, an obvious violation of international law, but Israel had less sensitivity to international law back in those days. He was kidnapped. He was held in Buenos Aires almost for 2 weeks, then he was drugged and spirited out of the country on a charter flight. Now, when he was captured, no one knew how he got there, and the details of his capture were only revealed months later in, of all places, Time magazine. And when that happened, Argentina protested to the UN, and Israel admitted its guilt somewhat, and the matter was closed. Argentina basically wanted admission of guilt. Israel said they would never do it again, and that's how it ended. The prosecution was led by then-Attorney General Gideon Hausner, who was later a cabinet minister, I think he was Minister of Transport a decade later, later the head of Yad Vashem as well. The defense was led by a German named Robert Servatius, who, irony of ironies, had to be paid by Israel. He was paid $30,000, a substantial sum in those days, for his defense. Eichmann was interrogated at length by the Israeli police. Three judges were chosen. One, you recall from last time, Binyamin Halevi, who was the judge in the Kastner trial, was in line to serve, but he was rejected because they felt he was too strong in his denunciation of the Holocaust, and they wanted it to have the appearance of propriety and fairness. The trial lasted months. A special room was set up in Beit Ha'am in Yerushalayim. Eichmann, of course, in the glass booth. Witnesses testified at length about their personal experiences. Hausner brought in the Columbia University professor of Jewish history, Salo Baron, to speak about the background of the Holocaust. People fainted on the witness stand. One writer, Yechiel Danur, just dropped unconscious to the ground. Another famous scene cried out, Atah Ha'ish, you are the man. Remember the accusation of Nasan Hanavi to David HaMelech. Eichmann's basic defense was twofold. One, that Israel had no jurisdiction over him because he was an Argentinian citizen and had been seized illegally, and Israel did not exist during the period of time in which his crimes took place, and that he was just a bureaucrat following orders, again, echoing the Nuremberg defense. The testimony was riveting. The trial was carried live on radio. And for the first time, and now we're talking 13 years into Israel's existence, for the first time survivors grew in the esteem of the average Israeli who saw laid out before them, hearing it on the radio and the testimony recorded every day in the newspapers, they saw the comprehensive nature of the Nazi machinery of death. And witnesses could not stop talking. It was almost as if, you know, a lawyer asked the question, what happened? And they would talk for hours, very cathartic, as if the floodgates opened, as if no one in 13 years had wanted to hear their story. And in fact, it was more or less so. And no detail was spared. And Hausner was insistent that the witnesses tell everything. Torture, physical abuse, sexual abuse, nothing was spared. Joel Brand testified about his aborted trucks for Jews scheme and his negotiations with Eichmann, whose political sensitivity as well. One of Eichmann's aides was now a top advisor to Konrad Adenauer, who's a chancellor of Germany, which by then was a close ally of Israel. And Adenauer appealed to Ben-Gurion to keep this person's name out of the proceedings because then he'd feel pressure to dismiss him. And Ben-Gurion told Hausner, and Hausner refused. He said he'll conceal nothing for the record, although he did downplay it. The oratory was lofty, and if you read about it, it's very powerful. Hausner spoke about European Jewry as, I quote, the heart of the nation, the source of its vitality, trying to impress upon the judges the evil that this man was able to perpetrate. In a somewhat less accurate description, he said they were all Zionists, and so they almost undermined the future existence of the Jewish state by the mass murder. Eichmann also testified like a bureaucrat. It wasn't his division that did it, it was another. It was really his superiors, and he was just the cog. He was caught between what he said was conscience and duty, and he followed duty as a good German. He was convicted, of course, December 15, 1961. Eichmann was sentenced to death for his crimes. Immediately, remember, we're talking Jews, a movement started to commute his sentence to life imprisonment and not to execute him. Martin Buber, professors from Hebrew University, places like a magnet for far leftists. The old Brit Shalom binational state gang. The Pope got involved, pleading that Eichmann be spared, his life be spared. His own children, by the way, did not necessarily ask for clemency. His own children, even though they maintained also the father was just following orders. Buber asked to meet Ben-Gurion, to plead with him personally, to spare Eichmann's life, even though it wasn't Ben-Gurion's call. The president could pardon a person. Ben-Gurion, always decorous, or almost always, went to visit Buber because Buber was older. Ben-Gurion was 75, Buber was 84. So he went to Buber's house, and he said he can't do anything about it. When this was going on in Israel during the ensuing months in early 1962, it's a big headline in Maariv, pardon for Eichmann with a question mark, 6 million times no. May 31st, 1962, Eichmann was hanged in Ramla prison. You may recall we hosted here at Shul, Shalom Nagar, son lives in our community, who was actually the hangman, a Yemenite Jew. They dafka sought a non-European Jew to do it. And he was cremated, his ashes scattered in the Mediterranean. There was criticism of the trial also. The gadfly Yeshayahu Leibovitz said it was a total failure, a waste of time. Eichmann himself, he said, is not guilty because he's just the product of 2,000 years of Christian history, the whole end of which is the destruction of the Jews. Perhaps, but Leibovitz, like he was very often, wrong on the effect that it had in Israel. There's a tremendous rise in Holocaust awareness and a splurge of Holocaust education. In fact, you could easily argue that there was no greater moment of Holocaust education in Israel than the months of the Eichmann trial. People became more sensitive to survivors. People became more sensitive to the vulnerabilities of Jewish history. The nuclear reactor at Dimona was built in 1960. It was also revealed by Time, who wrote that Israel was building an atom bomb. The first one was in Nahal Soreh, a little south of Tel Aviv. This national consciousness of the Holocaust would be evoked as war beckoned in 1967. A few other things of interest happened in the early 1960s. May 1960, the archaeologist, former chief of staff, Yigael Yadin, discovered the Bar Kokhba letters in a cave, which linked present Israel with past Israel, which was always very enticing to the Israeli population, which saw themselves, properly so, as the natural fulfillment of Jewish history. This followed the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls, first discovered by a goat herder near Qumran in 1947 and purchased by Yadin's father, the Hebrew University professor Elazar Sukenik. February 1961, Ben-Gurion resigned, one of many times he would resign. He resigned over the revelation of the Lavon affair. You recall from last time, that was the failed Egyptian spy operation, or the failed Israeli spy operation in Egypt, for which the then defense minister Pinchas Lavon was blamed. A government commission found that Lavon was blameless, essentially that he was framed, If he was framed, only higher-ups could have framed him. Ben-Gurion refused to accept the findings of the Commission of Inquiry, tried to quash further inquiry, and he said, if I can't accept a government commission, then the government has to fall. He resigned. He told the Mapai to choose between him and Lavon, and they did, and they chose Ben-Gurion. In the ensuing election, Mapai won fewer seats, but it won again. Ben-Gurion again became the prime minister until he finally retired for good in June of 1963. Actually, it didn't happen, but because he always wanted to come back. 1962, Foreign Minister Golda Meir visits the United States, visits President Kennedy, who becomes the first American president to sell arms to Israel, sold Israel Hawk missiles. Until then, Israel received almost all of its weapons from France, and warmer relations were established, especially after the coldness of the Eisenhower years. And by the end of the decade, the Americans would be Israel's major ally, perhaps Israel's only ally. Levi Eshkol becomes the prime minister, Ben-Gurion's natural successor, in June of 1963, when Ben-Gurion resigns again. Eshkol, originally Shkolnik, was from a Hasidic family in Russia. He became a Zionist, made Aliyah at the young age of 19, and was an agricultural worker. Very simple person. Worked his way up in the Histadrut, was a party functionary, was a very noted banterer, very earthy, had a very good sense of humor. You could fill half a book with his one-liners alone. He would regularly, strange in Israeli society at the time, just commingle Hebrew and Yiddish in a sentence, whether it was in a formal speech or in conversation with people. And he had a very sharp wit, and he was a politician. One of my favorite lines, I don't know why, just remember it, he promised a job to a certain person, and then he changed his mind. And the person came to complain to him, so he said to Eshkol, that you promised me. So Eshkol said, yes, I promise, but I never promise to keep my promise. And if you just think of the Yiddish inflection, you can imagine how it sounded. You know, the first draft of history perceived him as lackluster, in Ben-Gurion's shadow. Could very well be Ben-Gurion saw him just as a seat warmer. If Ben-Gurion would want to return, he was a technocrat. But actually, recent history has been kinder to Eshkol. And like many leaders, like Truman, even Begin, their service is remembered much more favorably by history than by their contemporaries. I imagine that's President Bush's hope as well these days. Eshkol did a number of very important things. He saw to its completion the construction of the national water carrier, Movil HaMayim HaArtzi, in 1964. It was a source of particular pride for Eshkol because he was the first director of Mikorot, the Israel water system, after 1948. The system pumped water from the Kinneret all the way to Be'er Sheva, 120 miles. If you drive in the Galil, certain points you could actually see the water carrier, and then down the coast as well. It increased Israel's water by 25% and the Negev's water by 75%. So it really opened up the northern part of the Negev to development, and Ashkelon and Ashdod, other cities all began to grow and develop. And this became an international success story of the desert blooming variety. Naturally, it was a provocation for the Arabs, like, you know, many things are. Arabs tried now to divert the waters of the Banyas and Chatzbani rivers, tributaries which fed the Jordan River. The Banyas and Chatzbani sources lie in Lebanon and Syria. Syria tried to do it literally by moving the earth and placing earth between and in the middle of the water to block the water from going into Israel. This is all the while, going back into the 50s and early 60s, Syria is constantly shelling Israeli settlements and shooting at Israeli farmers. Israel used to respond that every time, just a typical case. They responded in 1960, one point, by destroying a Syrian military post, and Israel was censured by the UN for that. Of course, the Syrians were not. Now, this water diversion project became a major incident, resulting in several skirmishes, clashes, until the Israeli Air Force destroyed all the Syrian earth-moving equipment, and in 1964, that particular parsha ended. Agav Urcha, by the way, Israel, Lebanon has a similar project underway today, as we speak, at the initiative of Hezbollah to cut off the water from the Banyas as it flows in, from the Chatzbani as it flows into Israel. But the government, in its incoherence of the last few years, has yet to respond. But in fact, they're working on a similar plan today. Eshkol became the first prime minister to make an official visit to the White House. You know, again, in our context, it's hard to imagine. Omar doesn't come that much, but if you think back, Netanyahu and Barak and Sharon, when he was healthy, they're flying into the White House, you know, every couple of weeks, it seems. But for 13 years, nobody came. There was no official visit. It was much harder to visit. The flight was much longer, and they weren't always as welcome. He visited President Johnson when Germany, under Arab pressure, halted military aid to Israel. Somehow Eshkol counter-pressured, and Germany relented, and even established diplomatic relations with Israel, which was itself very controversial. The first time a German ambassador presented itself and the German anthem was played, it was not a joyous moment for everyone in Israel. Sunday, January 5th, 1964, Paul VI becomes the first pope to visit Israel. Paul wasn't the friendliest pope around. He was clearly uncomfortable by his visit. He refused even to spend a night in Israel. He crossed at Megiddo from Jordan at Megiddo at 9:40 a.m., spent the day at the Kinneret and Nazareth visiting Christian sites, was welcomed by President Shazar and other dignitaries, spent much of the time responding to criticism by defending Pius XII and his efforts during World War II. To the Israelis, these visits always had a symbolic significance, maybe more so than even to the visitors, and despite the grudging nature of the visit, the Pope crossed back into Jordan at the Mandelbaum Gate at 9:07 p.m. So he spent roughly 11 and a half hours in Israel. Once in Jordan, he traveled north the next morning on a newly widened road that the Jordanians specially constructed with American money to Shechem. That highway was actually widened, as you know, for the IDF tanks and armored personnel carriers, which would use them 3.5 years later. The road was too narrow for the tanks. Had the Pope not come, it would have been a different war. Israel loves symbols. Another symbol, 1966, Shai Agnon won, Shmuel Yosef Agnon won the Nobel Prize for Literature in Stockholm. He started his speech commenting famously that he was born in Yerushalayim, but because of the destruction of the temple, his parents lived in Russia. The PLO was founded in 1964 by the Arab League. I had occasion to mention this on the radio this morning to a host who wasn't quite aware of that. The PLO was founded 3 years before the Six-Day War and 5 years before any settlement was founded. It consisted of a number of organizations. Its first leader was Ahmed Shukairi. Fatah, with Arafat as its head, dated back to 1958. Fatah only joined the PLO in 1969 with Arafat as the leader, so more on him next time. Their coming out party, so to speak, was an attempted sabotage of the national water carrier on January 1st, 1965. It was thwarted, but again establishing a pattern. The PLO claimed a tremendous success, destruction of the carrier and massive Israeli casualties, all of which was completely false, but Arabs have a different relationship to the truth than other people do. The goal of the PLO, as stated in its charter in 1964, was the destruction of Israel through armed struggle. That was the term that they used. And again, I can't emphasize enough that the PLO existed long before there was any settlement, and long before Judea, Samaria, and Gaza became controlled by Israel. It was originally controlled and funded and operated directly by Cairo under Nasser. Ben-Gurion came back, wanted to come back in 1964, because again the Lavon affair raised its head. Things were pointing at him, and it wasn't quashed in the Mapai. He opposed Eshkol, he demanded his place back as prime minister, and he ordered Mapai to choose between him and Eshkol. and they chose Eshkol and not Ben-Gurion. He formed a new party, Rafi, Rishimat Pa'alei Yisrael, with some familiar names, Shimon Peres and Moshe Dayan and others, but they won only 10 seats in 1965. He stayed in the Knesset, he became a little bitter, he flirted with Buddhism through much of the 60s, at one point even claiming he is now a Buddhist, but later retracting, formed another party in 1969 that won 4 seats, until he finally retired from the Knesset. The Knesset building itself was dedicated in 1966, paid for by James Rothschild, Rothschild family, on land that was leased from the Greek Orthodox Church for 99 years. You should know they've already said they want the land back in 2065. So I guess we have some time to work on that. All countries spy on each other, and all countries claim to be shocked by it. And Israel is no different. Israel had two famous spies who each played an important role in preparing for the Six-Day War. One was a German Jew named Wolfgang Lotz. A German Jew, his father was not Jewish. He emigrated with his mother to Israel before World War II, to the land of Israel. He was sent to Egypt in 1957. He spied for 8 years before he was caught. Just like Eli Cohen, we'll discuss in a moment, Lutz was able to ingratiate himself to the Egyptian military elite. He provided intelligence on missile launch sites. He sent a letter bomb, famous Mossad operation, a letter bomb to German scientists who were working on rockets to send to Israel for Egypt. Sent them a letter bomb to sort of discourage them from continuing, and he did discourage them. He was a bit of a loose cannon. He married a German woman to help him in Egypt with his cover story, even though he was married to an Israeli Jew in Israel. He was arrested on a fluke. Same thing happened to Cohen. Egypt was trying to flatter visiting East German dignitaries by arresting West German citizens. They arrested Lotz, and he thought his cover was blown, so he confessed. In the end, he was released in 1968 in a prisoner exchange after the Six-Day War. More famous was Eli Cohen. Eli Cohen, we encountered already last time. He was already active in Israeli intelligence in his native Egypt in the early 50s. He went to Israel in the mid-50s after the Lavon affair blew over. Lived in Bat Yam, he was a clerk, an auditor of some kind, but he was recruited by the Mossad, sent to live in Argentina as a Syrian businessman, Kamal Amin Tabat, and he was very friendly, personable, met many Syrians there, a lot of Syrians had settled there. He was resettled, so to speak, in Syria in 1960, became one of the most effective spies in history. He would radio Israel in code very, very often, with word of installations and maneuvers, weapons, personnel reports on different Syrian military leaders, the psychology of the people, the mindset of the government, etc. He befriended many Syrian generals. He was almost appointed the deputy minister of defense at one point. Very famously, he told the Syrians to plant eucalyptus trees on the Golan around the bunkers to provide shade, which of course also informed the Israelis where the bunkers were. Now this story was debunked by the post-Zionists in the 1990s, but I'm happy to say it was rebunked again after that, and apparently it is true. And if you drive along the Golan, you see that's where they are, and it was at his initiative. It's always difficult being a spy. He led a very difficult double life. Many today, in retrospect, hold that it wore him down and he began to be a little more reckless than he was in the early years. It was a very hard life. He was a religious Jew who had to pose as a Muslim, got a special heter from the army chaplain, from the Rav Rashi, to eat kosher and to live as a non-Jew. He was married, but he had to pose as an eligible bachelor. He was a husband and a father, but he rarely saw his children. And he was also discovered by a fluke. His apartment was near the Soviet embassy, and the KGB noticed increased radio traffic in the area, and they thought someone had bugged their embassy. And so they told Syrian intelligence, and it was coming from his building, and they broke into the next apartment, and they found nothing. But when the transmissions continued the next night, They came back and they discovered Eli Cohen. He was arrested, he was tortured, he was tried. Despite the pleas of the world, he was hanged in the Damascus public square May 18, 1965, 40 years old, but buried in secret in Damascus. His body's never been released despite the pleas and requests until today. Rav Gorin, who was the chief rabbi of Tzahal at the time, went to Bat Yam to Tiat Kriya with his mother and his wife and siblings. He left two daughters, 4 and 2 years old. Last words, he told his wife Nadia to remarry. She actually never did, and she still lives, she's in her very late 70s now. The Six-Day War reshaped the map of Israel and the state of Israel and really the history of the Middle East. And there's been much revisionism. Even last week, we heard some of it. I certainly did. Israel today is blamed as the aggressor, but the facts don't really bear that out. I told one of my interlocutors last week, a Jewish Arabist, that one. Just get a copy of the newspapers. Just read the headlines from June 1967. Just read the headlines, and you'll see a little more about the events of the time. The war was fomented by the megalomania of Gamal Abdel Nasser, who was the president of Egypt. He's a fanatical hater of Israel, a pan-Arabist. He's the poster boy of the Arab leader who builds his credentials by blaming everything bad that happens in his own country on Israel. And he really brought about the war. In a sense, it was an unnecessary war. There are always tensions on the border between Egypt and Israel, Israel and Jordan, Israel and Syria, and Lebanon as well. Fedayeen raids, constant Syrian artillery strikes. Things heated up in April 1967 when in a dogfight over the Kinneret, the IAF shot down 6 Syrian MiGs, losing none of their own, which was a portent of the air successes to come. Part of the IAF capability was fostered by another Mossad coup. In 1966, they persuaded an Iraqi pilot to defect with his MiG-23 intact. And in fact, he flew, before the Iraqis knew what had happened, he was gone. He flew from Iraq to Israel, and they took the MiG and dissected it. They shared the information with the Americans, who found it of tremendous use in Vietnam. The Mossad was even able to rescue his family from Iraq, which is hard to understand how, but they had air superiority. The strife, though, was really fomented primarily by the Soviets, who accused Israel, for unknown reasons, of planning for war during Israel's May maneuvers. Now, these things have a life of their own. You can see a small event just metastasized. I mean, so in the last few days here, a small thing just becomes blown out of proportion, and Nasser seized upon it in May of 67, holding daily rallies, threatening an end to Israel, promising its destruction, and he got caught up in his own rhetoric. May 15th, he moved armored divisions across the Suez Canal into Sinai, which is a breach of the agreement of 1956. May 17th, he demanded the ejection of the UN peacekeepers, and the UN Secretary General Utant readily agreed without even consulting the Israelis, pulled them out, so now there was no buffer. And of course, the casus belli on May 21st, Egypt blockaded the Gulf of Eilat and the Straits of Tiran, which were now closed to Israeli shipping again, just as in 1956, and had precipitated that war. 2 weeks of tension ensued, known in Israel as the Hamtana. Very difficult time. The world pleaded for restraint, demanded restraint, allowed diplomacy to work. Don't attack. Whatever, Israel should not be the first to attack. Johnson himself warned Eban, who was the foreign minister, if you attack first, you're alone. If you show restraint, then we are with you. The same Johnson, who when asked by Israel to act on the American promise to guarantee free passage through the Gulf of Eilat, said to Eban, we looked in the archives and we couldn't find that document that said that America would guarantee that free passage. De Gaulle threatened Israel. France then was a strong ally of Israel. Eshkol himself preached restraint. He came under withering criticism from the IDF and from the public, who saw him as an incompetent, as a ditherer, and the people saw a noose closing around Israel as every country prepared for war. Army was put on hold. It's very difficult, by the way, to get the army revved up and give them their orders and their operations. Unless you can't do it, you have to wait, call them back. And this happened a few times. Reserves were called up, and of course in Israel, most of the army's reserves, and all civilian life is thrown into disarray. The demonstrations throughout the world, most of you are older than me, so you remember better than I would. Jews were mobilized like at no time since World War II, and people spoke of another Holocaust, and it was a compelling argument even within Israel, because they saw they're outnumbered, outarmed, and there was fear as well. Some people flew to Israel to help out. Many Israelis left America to go back to Israel to fight. The country was on edge because they knew their only chance really was a first strike, and Eshkol was not ordering it. Some suggested even giving in to the blockade and saying, no, we'll live with it, we'll find some other way to get our shipping out.
Two major points that I don't know if you're going to mention it or not. Number one, in that Hula was being constantly bombarded.
Shelled by the Syrians. Right, that was constant. Right.
And Yushalayim, of course, without the Rovah, the Jordanians maintained all the high positions.
Right, but not, the Jordanians had not yet opened fire.
They were constantly sniping every day.
Right. That was a rifle fire. That's correct. But they actually then had no designs yet on the new city. In any event, it's interesting because we look back on these events, and you know, these things happen today as well. There are people who said, smooth it, so they blockade, so what? So we can't use a lot, we'll ship out of Haifa or Ashdod, find some other way to do it. Eshkol spoke on the radio to the nation on May 28th, and he stammered, and he sounded indecisive, and he sounded uncertain. And the generals protested, names familiar to us, Gandhi, Rehavam Ze'evi, who's the deputy director of operations. Aaron Yariv, who became the head of army intelligence after the war, said, we have to take care of our own business. Can't rely on anyone else. Ariel Sharon, if we do nothing, the enemy will lose its fear of us, which is our most powerful weapon. If only he heard himself speak a few years ago. Meanwhile, to add to the tension, the chief of staff, Yitzhak Rabin, broke down in early June. Maybe June 1st, May 31st. Some say it had a nervous breakdown. He says it was nicotine poisoning, but he disappeared for 24, 36 hours, could not participate in any of the deliberations. And basically, he was not heavily involved after that. They bypassed him, especially with a reconfiguration of the cabinet. For the first time, Eshkol formed a national unity government. Menachem Begin entered the cabinet as minister without portfolio. He suggested, ironically enough, that Ben-Gurion, who refused to talk to him, should become the prime minister, thinking that he'd be able to unite the nation and give them assertive leadership, but that was rejected by Eshkol, among others. In what Eshkol's wife described as a coup, Eshkol was demoted as defense minister. Moshe Dayan was the hero of 1956. He was brought in as defense minister. Ben-Gurion joined the government as well, and the lineup was set, and this all bypassed Rabin too. Azer Weitzman, who's the former head of the IAF and was now the director of operations during the war, said to Rabin after the war, you know, Weitzman had a very sharp tongue, loved the barbed insult. He said, and of course every general's a little arrogant anyway, he said to Rabin after the war, he writes this in his memoirs, you walk around like Yehuda HaMaccabee, but you're the biggest bluff in Israel, because they knew who was and who wasn't, who was involved, who wasn't involved. Army was poised, ready to go, Nasser threatened, war was imminent, and finally Eshkol gave the go-ahead. It was Monday, June 5th. The Israeli planes took off 7:45 a.m., At 8:15, the IAF launched a lightning strike against 13 Egyptian airfields, which they knew everything they had to know about through Wolfgang Lutz and his reports over the years. They essentially eliminated the Egyptian Air Force on the ground. This was Weizmann's plan. It had been in the works and on the shelf for years. And you look back to the Six-Day War, people were not religious at all, completely secular. And even the generals, they recognized Hashgachas Hashem. Amazing things happen that you just, if you look at the literature, it's a very fine book by Michael Oren called 6 Days of War, you should all read. The planes, as they were taking off, were all spotted by Jordanian radar, and they notified the Egyptians, but the Egyptians didn't understand them. They changed their codes, and they didn't tell Jordan they changed their codes. The word didn't go through. And Egypt had Israel attacked then because the morning sorties were finished, and the pilots come back for breakfast at 7:45. So it was all the planes just waiting on the airfield to be destroyed. Almost the entire IAF was in the air at the time, and the airspace of Israel was basically defenseless. Open to Syria and Jordan, they didn't attack. When the first day of the war, troops poured into Sinai. Most of Israel's defense forces were in Sinai. The central command was unmanned. Uzi Narkis, who was head of the Yerushalayim front, said the security of the center was based on miracles because they basically had very few soldiers there. Jordan didn't attack. Troops and tanks poured into Sinai. War, you know, is very unpredictable. Another famous name, a general, Raful Eitan, said as they went into Sinai, every unintended action they took and every unintended action we took always turned out to our advantage. And Eitan, who was as secular as they come, said, I quote, apparently someone in heaven was watching over us. People were in fear, palpable fear, because of the situation. I remember, I was a young child, I was in fourth grade at the time, but we had no school during the week. The Rebbeim just sat clustered around the radio, listening to what was going on, non-stop Tehillim across the world. Meanwhile, Syria kept shelling. Many, Dayan, Chaim Moshe Shapir, who's the head of the Maftal, were opposed to opening a Syrian front because they wanted to focus on Egypt. It was only sporadic gunfire from Jordan because they received messages from Israel, stay out, we'll fight Egypt and we'll leave you alone. Israel's Air Force. And that led Hussein into battle, and he opened fire on Tuesday, June 6th, with heavy artillery into Yerushalayim, into Netanya, and other cities. You know, Hussein died with the reputation of a moderate, which is fine, maybe he changed over the years. His order of the day, that day, to his troops were, in short, kill Jews with your weapons, with your hands, even with your teeth, but kill Jews. Israel responded. IDF went north and south as the battle in the Sinai was easier than they thought. They were able to divert troops to the center of the country. They went to Shechem, they went to Hebron and captured those areas. Dean Rust, who was the Secretary of State, notified Israel Tuesday night already of Hussein's request for a ceasefire. Begin especially, but others as well, began pressuring Eshkol and Dayan to enter the old city immediately before the world stops them. Rav Goren said to General Barlev, Chaim Barlev, who commanded the zone at the Rockefeller Museum very early, very Wednesday morning, June 7th, if you don't go in, then history will never forgive you if you sit here and fail to enter. On Wednesday, the 28th of Iyar, 6 a.m., the IDF began its assault on the old city. It was the place of most resistance on the Jordanian front. The Jordanian army fled from Yudan Shomron on Tuesday already, but the fight in the old city was very, very tough. They entered, as we know, through the Shar Ariot, the Lion's Gate, which was wide enough, barely for tanks, in Israeli military code. The gate was known as Vietnam. It must be their own joke. They ran, the Lion's Gate, of course, is in the eastern part of the old city. They entered through there and fought their way to Har Habayit. Famous words of Mata Gur, paratrooper, colonel, Har Habayit Biyadenu, down through the Mugrabi Gate, which once again is in the news, to the Kotel, where Avgaran, who entered very early, blew the shofar of his father-in-law, Rav David Cohn, the famous Noz of Yerushalayim. Dayan said, we have returned to this place, never again to leave. Through Shar Tzion, which you know where it is, it was a brigade commanded by Captain Eli Kedar, who had been a POW 19 years earlier, at the age of 15. He was captured by the Jordanians fighting in the Jewish quarter. He commanded the assault on the Shaar Tzion, he linked up with another brigade at Shaar HaShvot, Dungate, and they made their way to the Kotel. Tremendous rejoicing broke out in Israel across the world. Yitzhak Rabin said, in a very eloquent, moving statement, he said, "This is the peak of my life." He said he always harbored a secret dream of being in the forefront of those who would liberate Yerushalayim. And he said, countless generations of Jews murdered, martyred, and massacred for the sake of Yerushalayim say to you, Nachamu, Nachamu Ami, Yomar Elokeihem. Begin that day demanded that the Jewish quarter be restored. And in fact, within a few days, they destroyed the entire area, the Mugrabi quarter, which is right in front of the Kotel, to make the large plaza that there exists now. And at the time, I guess, nobody seemed to be bothered by it.
There was quite a bit of protest, by the way, internationally, at that time against
them. Didn't reach me. Right.
Now,
yeah. On Tuesday, by the way, the army reached Sharm el-Sheikh. Thursday, June 8th, they reached the Suez Canal. The war with Egypt basically ended. That same day, the American spy ship, the Liberty, was attacked and disabled in the Mediterranean, 13 miles off the coast of the Sinai. The Israelis always said it's an accident. They didn't see the American flag in the fog of war. The problem was there really was no fog of war there. It was just a single ship. The bottom line is the ship shouldn't have been there to begin with. The Israelis were told it was moving out the day before. The very possible is monitoring communications. Some say they attacked it deliberately for a variety of possible reasons, including they heard a report of a possible amphibious landing by Egypt on the Gaza coast, and there was a report, turned out to be false, of shelling in Gaza. There was a report that the Americans were monitoring Israeli communications to make sure Israel did not invade the Golan. Whatever it was, and I can't judge, Israel later paid $12 million in compensation to the families of the 34 Americans killed and 171 Americans wounded. Of course, the Liberty is still a bonanza for Jew haters until today. Now, Dayan was very hesitant to capture the old city and to capture the Suez Canal and the Golan, but in fact he reversed himself and he ordered an assault on the Golan on Thursday, led by David Elazar, Zachur Latov, American ambassador to the UN, Arthur Goldberg, very strategically placed to talk, delay the ceasefire, even though America was pressuring Israel to stop and the world had really lost patience with Israel's successes. By the fourth day, by the fifth day, Shabbos, June 10th, was to be the last day in any event, the sixth day of the war, Israel succeeded in dislodging Syria and ending the threats to the north. The generals in the morning, early in the morning, pleaded for a few hours to clean up. Elazar said to Eshkol, "Give us to 4 p.m. And Eshkol answered, 4 p.m. can mean 5 or 6. To which Elazar said, "Adoni, 4 means 2 or 3. And in fact, they finished early afternoon. Kunetra fell, Hermon as well, and everything changed. In the aftermath, it was a new world. Israel had tripled in size. It had new strategic depth, new problems as well, and new opportunities. Arab casualties were 25 to 1 against Israel's. Israel admitted 679 of the soldiers killed. It was closer really to 800, which, you know, we think of it as a painless war. 800 the soldiers dead per capita in American terms is 80,000 soldiers. Thousands of Arab soldiers, thousands, maybe 6,000-7,000 in Egypt alone, were exchanged for 24 Jews, establishing another pattern of the disproportionate nature of these transactions. There are 1.5 million Arabs now came under Israel control. Chaim Herzog, later to be the president, was appointed the military governor of Yesha. He met, in a famous story he recounts in his book on the wars of Israel, met with the local Arab notables in Hebron. They came with a white flag. They came anticipating they would be executed as the leaders of the people. And he said, Chas v'shalom, in a sense, and they cried. And they said to Herzog, "If it had been us, we would have killed you." Dayan leaves the Waqif in charge of the Temple Mount, reviving the Arab spirit, and as we know, paving the way for future difficulties until today. For the Jewish people, it's an unbelievable sense of fulfillment and impending redemption. Jews felt that the Mos HaMashiach were imminent. Rav Kook, for example, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kohen Kook, that was one of the great svarim written in the early 70s that I read when I was a teenager, Ayelet HaShachar. On Yom HaTzmut in the Merkaz HaRav, it was celebrating, Rav Kook gave a klap, and he said that when the partition resolution was voted on, dancing in the streets, and he was crying and had to react, because he said, like the Pasuk in Yoel, let our tzi chilek, where they divided the land, how could we be happy? And he said he went to Rav Charlap, who had been close to his father, and they sat in his father's study. Rav Kook is gone 14 years already, 13 years. They sat in his study, you know how to process these events, and they said, finally, Meis Hashem Hoisazos, we have to accept it. In any event, Yom HaTzmut, Leil HaTzmut, 1967, he cried out, Rav Kook, Et Artzi Chileku. They've divided our lands a month before the war. Eifo Chevron Shalanu, Banachu Shachachim Ota. Where's our Chevron? We've forgotten about it. Eifo Shechem Shalanu, Banachu Shachachim Ota. Where's our Shechem? We've forgotten about it. Eifo Yericho Shalanu, Eifo Eber Hayarden Shalanu. A folk called Regev Veregev Me'artzeinu Akdosha. Where is every clump of earth of our holy land? Ha'im bi'adenu levater chas v'shalom afil a millimeter me'aretz Hashem. Can we forego even a millimeter of God's land? He didn't like the complacency. The complacency. Well, it was prophetic. 3 weeks later, it was all changed. Chevron, and Shechem, and Yerushalayim, and Yericho. Naomi Shemer had released in May Yerushalayim Shel Zahav. People think it came after the war. It came before the war, Yerushalayim Shel Zahav. And the original verses spoke about returning to Yericho, returning to the Ir Atika. After the war, prophetic, she changed the stanzas, added one, in fact, to take recognition of the new events. In Moscow, Jews celebrated in public to the horror of the communists, and it galvanized the Soviet Jewry movement. In America, there was a sudden awakening of Jewish consciousness. David had defeated Goliath. It was pride in Jewish identity. It was Jewish renewal. A new interest in Aliyah in America. The ghosts of the Holocaust, in a sense, were exorcised. The Holocaust, the second Holocaust, was averted. No longer would Jews only be victims. And that was a sense that pervaded Jewish life. I remember very vividly, I was not even 10 years old at the time, going to my grandparents' house, Alayhem HaShalom, and my great-grandfather, the old Zaidi, was up in his room, he was writing a sefer, his last sefer. He would die November that year. And I picked up something in school that week, I didn't really understand what I was saying. But it's apropos, Yom Diyomo. I said to my great-grandfather, Mishenichnas Adar Marbim B'Simcha, Adar Eshkol Dayan Rabin. Mishenichnas Adar Marbim B'Simcha. I guess I knew what I was saying, but he understood, and my grandfather, and my father, and that's how Jews saw the world. Within days, the Kotel Plaza was cleared, because Shavuos is exactly a week later. The whole Mugrabi quarter was flat. And the plaza was laid out in record time, strange for Israeli contractors. 1 week later, Shavuos Day, 250,000 Jews came to Davin. It's about 10% of the country. And the Orthodox population, it might have been half or maybe 60% of Orthodox Jews came to Davin that morning. It's only one day also. People thought peace was at hand, because why would the Arabs fight anymore? We're here to stay, they can't defeat us. Israel sought a comprehensive peace treaty with every state to solve the refugee problem. No one even thought the Palestinians thought there were Palestinians who would claim the right to a state. No one thought such a people even existed. Nasser resigned before the war ended and then orchestrated his return a few days later. Arab countries were in shock. Soviets were embarrassed. They broke relations with Israel, France, De Gaulle was very angry that Eshkol did not listen to him. They froze relations, and it's been cold with France ever since then. For Israel, there was political disappointment. In September, the Arab League in Khartoum issued their three no's, no recognition, no peace, no negotiation. That policy remained until they became a little more clever and more sensitive to public relations, even if they still feel that way. Some Jews, Yeshaya Leibowitz was one, Ben Gurion to some extent, except Yerushalayim, said, give it all back, that this would never end, it's no panacea, etc. So that started immediately after the war. It didn't wait for a few decades. 1968, the war of attrition began. I'm sorry, in the fall, the UN passed Resolution 242, which called for Israeli, they fought over the language as lawyers do, called for Israeli withdrawal from, quote, territories occupied in the recent conflict, specifically not including the word the territories, which Israel and Arthur Goldberg maintain would have meant all the territories. Instead, territories mean some territories, to allow for negotiations among all, quote, states in the region, assuming that the Palestinian problem was not an issue of a state or of sovereignty, but just a humanitarian concern. It was not to be, and it's one of the great disappointments. The war of attrition began shortly later. In 1968, November 68, America became the primary arms supplier to Israel, and the arms race was on between the Americans and the Soviets to arm their respective clients in the Middle East. Early, the Soviets had provided the Egyptians with SAM missiles, anti-aircraft missiles, when in 1968 they began firing artillery at Israeli positions in Sinai, at the Suez, with tremendous loss of life and loss of planes as well. Israelis would bomb, they hadn't yet adjusted the SAM missiles, and the planes were shot down. Eventually, Israel solved the SAM missile problem. It helped the Americans also in Vietnam, by the way. That missile problem would resurface in the Yom Kippur War because the Soviets also made adjustments. The war stopped only when Israel began bombing deep into Egypt, Cairo and Alexandria, and then Nasser called a halt. But this non-war, until recently, by the way, the last few years, Israel never called an official war. But now it's known as Milchemet HaHatasha, the war of attrition. The non-war claimed almost 700 lives, including my cousin. Almost as many as in the Six-Day War, but it was much more demoralizing. And in retrospect, the Arabs found a new tactic, one that they would use regularly after that, except for the Yom Kippur War, and that is wars of attrition, the death of 1,000 cuts, something which will wear down the civilian population, and of course terror, which the PLO began in earnest in 1968 with airplane hijackings and bombings. So that notion of having a non-conventional war, a war not of armies, a war just where something happens every few days and nobody can rest, that developed now, and that tactic has really worked. The second big change was that Israel dug in behind the Barlev line along the Suez. And this was a change in their offensive strategy, which in the military strategy, which eventually, unfortunately, cost them. Because they became stuck in a response mode. They were only responding to what was happening. They were no longer taking the initiative, which had been their great tactic, their successful tactic in all the previous wars. Levi Eshkol died suddenly in December 1969, not fully appreciated for creating the framework for the full realization of the ancient vision of the prophets. When he came into power in 63, the small country, much more vulnerable, without an effective water system, without developed industries or growing cities. He left with a large country that was successful. Israel restored to its land in full, triumphant, with opportunities for spiritual and material development in abundance. But Israel also had a certain sense that the inevitability of peace, the invincibility of its army, and even a certain hubris in its strategic position. Eshkol's successor, Golda Meir, and the people of Israel would pay a price for that hubris in just a few years. But at this point, as the 60s end, Israel is never larger, never more self-sufficient, began extracting oil from the Abu Rodes oil fields in Sinai, never more powerful, and never more confident. I thank you very much.